Welcome back to the Real Talk with Dana podcast, where we talk all things nutrition, health, fitness, and mindset with a healthy side of sarcasm. I'm your host, Dana Montes of Real Food with Dana. I'm a nutritionist and body image coach, teaching women how to heal their relationship with food and their bodies, ditch the diet cycle for good, and truly thrive with real food, one delicious meal at a time. Oh, hey there, internet and podcast friends. We're taking this episode in a little bit of a different direction today because although last week I said we're going to be talking a lot about gut health, we are going to be talking about that, but a lot more today we're going to be talking about the mind-body connection, and I want you guys to be thinking about how this relates back to gut health. So today's guest is Stacy Dawkins. She is the director of the YP School of Yoga, a 500-hour experienced registered yoga teacher, a corrective exercise specialist through NASM, and a nutritional therapy practitioner who has a passion for the mind-body connection part of health. So on today's episode, we're talking about yoga and breathing and how our posture can impact our cortisol production. We're doing a little bit of nerding out about the nervous system, and we're talking on the more woo-woo side of things too, on how to bring more awareness to that mind-body connection and how that can help manage stress through digital well-being and gratitude, through self-awareness and self-inquiry, and self-compassion. So like I said, while we're focusing on gut health a lot this month, this is something to keep in mind as well, because a lot of the time, it's our thoughts around the food and the practice of eating and how we are eating, whether that's in the fight or flight sympathetic state or in the rest and digest parasympathetic state, that can impact our gut health and our digestion and inflammation in diverse ways, not only the food that we are eating itself. All right. Well, Stacy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you as well. I'm excited to be here.
So why don't we get started with talking about you, because that's what we are here for, right? Mm-hmm. Tell the listeners about your personal health journey and what led you to specialize in the very cool thing that you do today.
Okay. Yeah. So it's been a while. I've been in the health and the wellness industry for quite some time now. We opened our first yoga studio in 2005. So I guess my journey, you know, really my awakening around shifting, you know, how I live my life and what I do for myself really probably began back when I was a mother of three toddlers. So I'm like many young mothers, just keeping my, you know, head above water, surviving from day to day. And I just started realizing just the amount of stress that I had in my life and just beginning to notice that maybe I could take some actions that would change how I feel. And so that's really where it began. And that was many years ago. I'll have to say my oldest son is turning 23 today. So it's been quite a long journey. But through understanding just various things, I remember one day, I always tell the story how I was standing in the kitchen and I opened up a drawer and I opened up a book and it said, there was a sentence that said, you are not your thoughts. And I was like, huh? I did not know that. And that really, as crazy as that sounds, was really profound to me as a young mother. And so I started to dive into just the topic of mindfulness, mindful awareness, embodiment, and things like this. But yeah, that was the very beginning of leading me into really embracing yoga and mindfulness and turning it into a career eventually. And along the way, I had some health issues as well at a young age. It was in my 20s, early 20s. I ended up having my gallbladder removed and made the mistake that, I don't know, a lot of people, you know, not being aware of my body and just the implications of having that done and things that I could have done. I just didn't know what I didn't know now. But so that really kind of spurred me into bringing more health focus into my career as well. And really I studied nutritional therapy about 5 years ago. And I really just did it to increase my own knowledge and to be able to support myself and my family. So I don't practice as a nutritional therapist, but I really honor all of the knowledge that I gained studying that. And yeah, so here I am today, still doing the work, you know, not perfectly there.
Is anyone perfectly there though? I think
oh my gosh,
that,
yeah.
Well, I think I'm sure we'll talk about this too, but even that striving for perfection in any aspect of life, like 100% perfection, can actually lead us down a path of not so great health issues.
So true. So true.
So how did you get into yoga in the first place? Did you grow up as an athlete?
You know, I did not grow up as an athlete. I think I always, you know, reflecting back on my childhood, I think that I was always secretly longing to be very physical, wanting to play sports and such, but I never really had the confidence. And I feel like I didn't have that champion in my life, you know, someone who encouraged me to do it. And so I never did. I did little things here and there, but I never really was very physical, definitely not in athletics when I was young. When my babies were first, you know, around, and I had really little kids, and I was really having this longing to get into my body for whatever reason and to be physical, because it was something that I really hadn't had as a part of my life, I started cycling. And as soon as I just felt my experience, like the strength in my body and things like that, it was something that I wasn't used to. And so that really got my attention, that there was something magical about physicality and feeling, you know, body sensations and things like that. So that kind of steered me in that direction. I did a lot of time road cycling, and then eventually my back was hurting and I heard yoga could help. And so that was really what took me to yoga in the very beginning.
That's amazing. And then you have this like very cool specialty in yoga of combining all of your different nutrition and kinesiology degrees and like just your knowledge of the body with yoga teacher training, to where you've started to talk about how to align yoga postures best to suit your bio-individuality. And this is something that honestly I never really heard of before or like thought of, which makes total sense if you come from a background of nutrition of like, okay, obviously not everyone's the same and no one diet is going to work for everyone. But then I never really thought to apply that to yoga specifically of like, oh, you know, everyone that goes to a yoga class, those poses might not be the best for them. So how did you get into that? And then could you talk more about how you start to align yoga postures to best suit everyone's unique bio-individuality?
Yeah, that's something I'm really passionate about. And so I guess, you know, it's something that was always occurring to me that, wow, our bodies are different. And early in my studies of yoga and yoga anatomy, I studied with a teacher named Paul Grilley, and he's really big on teaching bioindividuality as far as the skeletal structure goes. And that really shifted the way I looked at the body and the way I teach alignment and postures and such. And then along the way, I have to say, when I was in nutrition school, I remember, you know, listening to a lecture one day, and I wrote in my notebook, I wrote down, it just came to me, I thought, well, we're really just innate intelligence coaches, you know, being in that field, it's like, really, we're just helping people to tune more into themselves to understand what best suits their needs. And when that really started to make sense to me with nutrition, I started thinking, well, it's really the same in everything. And if we're very different, you know, we can be shaped very differently structurally at our core from our skeleton. So bones are shaped differently from body to body, which changes the way certain articulations feel in the body. And then there's lots of other things, you know, that's just the skeletal structure, the soft tissues, you know, we have our own, we all have our unique histories and experiences that shape everything, that shape our mental health needs, that shape our nutritional needs, and also shape our movement needs. And so, you know, me, and then I, you know, all along the way, I've been building this, you know, really keen understanding of the body. And I started to really realize, yeah, if you really understand the body structurally, we are different from person to person. And plus, it went beautifully hand in hand with the practice of mindful awareness, which is really what I, you know, think the nectar of yoga is in my teaching philosophy, is mindful awareness. And we can teach people, whether it's nutrition or movement, we can teach them to be better followers of, you know, here's how it goes, do it like this. And in a sense, we can teach people to tune out more. We can teach them to stay on this automatic pilot path, or we can teach them to really start honoring and sensing their own bodies. And it just the same as it is in nutrition, it's the same in movement, like to sense and feel your own body and to understand how it feels and to get more in tune with that is really the nectar of the practice of yoga. And so it went so well together, you know, understanding the body and this increased sense of embodiment, to me, go really well together. And that's really at the heart of what I teach.
Yeah, that is so cool. So what about using yoga as a tool for cultivating self-compassion and stress resilience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we just got off of leading. We led a 10-day program. We just finished it a couple of days ago. And so it's really fresh in my experience, where we invited, we had a scholarship contest where it was for young women ages 15 to 20, they applied, and we chose 10 girls. And it was just the most incredible experience. I will say it's probably been the most incredible experience of all of my teaching career, was having these young girls in. And the whole aim for the program was to do just what you just asked me. It was to help them just increase their awareness around self-compassion and stress resilience. So one of the big things that we focused on during the training was really just the concept of self-awareness. I know for me, when I was 15, the concept of self-awareness was like, so far from my understanding, I didn't even know what that meant. You know, and so teaching these girls really pragmatic tools for awareness. So we did things like, we did a little bit of seated meditation, but we just did a little bit of that. We did breath awareness work. We did mindful art work. And then we really looked at how doing movement is the same thing. And so along the way, the girls got to learn some anatomy. So they learned more about their bodies, and they learned how to sense and feel things like spinal extension, spinal flexion, and different postures. And so we spent this week of really getting into this concrete embodied sense. And then we had lots of self-inquiry and discussion along the way at how that state of mindfulness affected our ability to be in relationship with ourselves, as well as relationships with people around. And so within that, the whole idea and better understanding of self-compassion begins to arise for anyone. And along the way, I was really excited about sharing with them these tools for breath awareness. And then along with that, some of the actual science. So what's happening in our bodies when we take longer exhale breaths, and what's happening in our bodies when we notice the stressful thoughts we're having and we have some compassion around them. And so I shared that with them, and it was kind of tricky for me, because I thought, okay, how am I going to teach about the vagus nerve and the autonomic nervous system to these teenage girls in a way that they're interested in it? And it was a challenge for me, but so much fun. And just happy to say that they're so interested. They really want to learn about their bodies, and I could just see the sense of empowerment building in them from day to day. And so those are some of the really basic foundational pieces of how we help them to at least start to investigate the idea of self-compassion and stress resilience.
Oh, that's so amazing. And that does sound so rewarding. Definitely very challenging. I teach swimming, and I also teach nutrition to my swim kids, who are from age, 7 and 8 all the way through high school. So it's a lot of varying abilities, but figuring out how to teach those could be very complex scientific concepts that are related to nutrition to them in a way that's easy to understand, but still impresses on how complicated it is and how we really need to understand our bodies. Like, completely understand that challenge, and major props to you for getting it across them in a way that they will not only understand, but then can take forward with them so much earlier in life than so many of us other people that got to understand it.
Yes. Yes.
So I was reading an article that you wrote a couple of months ago about how body language clues can show you if someone is stressed or not, and how their posture plays into the fight or flight response and cortisol production. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, and I'll say that. So the article, I'm trying to remember the article, but it was really surface, I think. So it was a really good look at the very beginning of how we could see body language and stress and things like that. But there's so much more. I just wanted to add, there's so much more beyond that. But for what I wrote about then, it was, just about just the basic, really basic, what does it feel like when you're sitting at your desk to work, and how you're holding your body. And there's a lot of research that conflicts. So we don't know if does the actual way we're sitting create the mental and physiological state, or does the mental and physiological state create the way we're sitting? So it's a two-way street, and I think there's evidence that shows both, but it's really, you know, it comes back to that embodied sense and a self-awareness, like being, you know, knowing that we can shift and hold our body in a way that can send messages to our physiology, to our mind, even to our, you know, our neuroendocrine system. And then we can hold certain thoughts and be in certain stressful mental states that can, before we know it, have a direct effect on how we're holding our body. And it's really basic what one would think of as good and bad posture. And so that was the very like basic surfacey information of that article that I shared. But, you know, there's so much more. And I don't know if you've dove into the polyvagal theory at all, but the polyvagal theory is this sort of really fascinating explanation of how the whole fight or flight versus rest and digest is one way we've always looked at the autonomic nervous system. But there's really more to it than that. And the polyvagal theory shares with us that there's this way of the way that our physiology responds in facial expressions. And so it goes way deeper than just, am I stressed? Am I holding bad posture or not? But yeah, that would be a really good thing if anyone's interested in researching more or just learning more about that, is the polyvagal theory.
Yeah, that's so cool. I've never heard of that before. Could you go a little bit more into that?
Yeah, so the polyvagal theory. So the basic of it is, I think it's in the 1990s, there's a man by the last name of Porges, P-O-R-G-E-S. I believe he's a neuroscientist, but he's the one who's really revealed all of these new theories in the past decade, I guess, about the polyvagal theory. And the way that most of us look at the autonomic nervous system is that there's fight or flight, you know, the sympathetic side, and then there's the rest and digest, or the parasympathetic side. And so we're always thinking, you know, how do we balance between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic? Well, Porges introduced the idea that with the parasympathetic side, there's not just the rest and digest, but there's another side. And I don't know, remember the exact term, but you could think of it as like immobilization or freezing. You know, one way I've heard of it, the analogy used with it a lot is like a lizard, how reptiles will freeze, you know, and they'll just be frozen and there's no bodily or emotional response. Another way I've heard it compared to is, you know, say for example, we have someone who is suffering from PTSD and they're, you know, struggling with mental health, but they're not in a state of fight anymore. They've kind of slid into, you know, disconnect, not being connected to family and society and things like that. And so that's this other side of the parasympathetic theory, which I think is fascinating because I've always thought of it myself as fight or flight or rest and digest. But it's now, as Porges describes it, it's fight or flight, rest and digest, and then this immobilized state as well. So it would mean like almost like sliding too far into the sympathetic side, where we often think of to regain balance autonomically, that most people, and the predominant tendency is that we're undertoned parasympathetically. But for some people, they need to be sort of sparked into that sympathetic mode. For instance, some people may need to, you know, bring that sympathetic spark up in them, whether it be the way they move or activities they do, or maybe journaling or thought exercises they have. Is that making sense?
Yeah, definitely. And that's so cool because it's such a different way of thinking about it that, I mean, we get so ingrained in these ways of thinking that it's like, okay, it's a dual way of thinking about it. And these things are mutually exclusive. You can only be in parasympathetic or you can only be in sympathetic. And it's just, it's really interesting to even consider that there is another option there.
Yeah. It's been something that's really fascinated me over the past couple of years because I'm like, oh, I've been teaching it this particular way. But, and of course it's a theory, but there's a lot of really strong, heavy evidence to support that theory.
So cool. So one of the things that you were talking about in the article that I really found super interesting was that when people have, like, because of basically the digital age and social media, and we're so attached to our phones, right? In addition to this like forward shoulder that we get from being hunched over and being on the computer and being on our phones, when people are standing or presenting that way later, aside from it being caused by our phones, it's actually because we're in a more, what am I going to say? we're in the more fight or flight response here, and that's just showing that. So like when the body is having a lot of excess cortisol, it can then also not only cause the blood sugar dysregulation, all of the hormone imbalances and stuff like that, but it also can manifest in this body position. Like, why is that?
I don't know of any really solid science that says definitively why that is. And it may be out there, but I don't know of any really definitive science, but there's lots of theories and we could swing from different ends of the spectrum. One theory I know I've heard a lot about the iliopsoas muscle and how its connection to the fight or flight state. And so if you think about when we're preparing for battle, you know, and that's the nature of the fight or flight state. I'm getting ready to battle whatever I need to battle. And our core muscles that we need, these strong muscles that we need to use for even physical battle, get more blood flow and they're activated in a different way. And so the iliopsoas is this really strong trunk muscle. And so I've seen different theories that connect the iliopsoas to that idea of fight or flight. Again, I don't know any clear scientific evidence, but it may be out there, but I know I've heard of that theory. And then on another not necessarily scientifically proven theory is just the heart space. And so the front of the body, our respiration space, the space where our heart resides and this kind of closing in around it, that is connected to this more depressed and anxious state. It's sort of a defense mechanism, protective state in the body. So that's the best I know as far as theory wise.
Right. And then how is the type and the quality of our breathing related to that?
So again, it's the respiration space. So if you think about, in yoga, we talk about why do we inhale on specific moves and exhale on specific moves? Well, the inhale, the way I teach basic, beginner practitioners, the inhale is always when we're expanding the respiration space. So we're lifting up, we're expanding. And if we had a clear visual of how the diaphragm needs to work and the space for the lungs to expand, that makes sense. And then when we're closing down or twisting in a yoga pose, it's often the action that's correlated with an exhalation breath. And so really simply, it's hard to get full respiration to happen when we're in that sort of physically compressed state of a slouched forward position. And then, there is really clear science that connects respiration rate with sympathetic tone or parasympathetic tone. So that, fast, shallow breathing is highly correlated with more of a stress state. And then a longer breath, slower breath, especially longer expiratory or exhale breath is strongly correlated with more parasympathetic balance. So where we need to go autonomically.
So let's give an example here. We have a person or, 90% of the people in this world that are like a little bit hunched over and say we're mostly stuck in that sympathetic state of shallow breathing. How can we start to create new patterns so that our default tends towards the more belly breathing? How can we switch our default state?
To more toward balance. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes it's hard to say. Self-observation, happens in many forms, self-awareness. And sometimes we could say, just start noticing when you're stressed, which that's really valuable as well. And that's a whole nother pathway. But I really like that teaching people nuts and bolts mechanically about their body and to start, especially people who aren't really used to doing that whole self-awareness or self-observation thing. Nuts and bolts about the body are a really great doorway in to body self-awareness. So I like to just tell people about just noticing how they're sitting, like to start, because then the body sends a message to the whole mental state. And so starting there and really just, finding, being aware of how you're sitting when you're working and taking breaks, obviously standing much up and moving as much as possible. But a lot of people think that proper, like healthy sitting starts with the shoulders and the ribs, but really it starts with the pelvis. So aligning the pelvis, I read one time, someone said, as if you had a long cat tail and you're going to kind of wiggle the tail behind you. And so this little bit of anterior tilt in the pelvis without blowing the front ribs forward into a big backward bend position, which can happen, but just, pelvis tilted forward just a little, and then from there, sort of telescoping the spine nice and tall so that the chest space is open. And then I teach more in-depth workshops about noticing things like arm bone placement, like the tendency when we're typing or working forward is a little anterior placement of the arm bone. So it shifts forward a little and it rotates in a little. And then that lends to that overall eventual chronic pattern of everything kind of rolling in forward. And so teaching these little bitty nuts and bolts pieces can be very helpful for people, not only to, you know, notice how they're sitting, but to increase their self-awareness, to increase their ability to be mindfully aware, and definitely correlated to self-compassion. And then all of the other, you know, deeper inner self-observations, I think, tend to happen normally. Like, how is my mental state right now? What is my attitude? That sort of thing.
So the listeners can't see this, but I have a standing desk and I'm trying to do exactly all of the things that you just said with my posture. And I will say that my like breathing chamber feels a lot more open.
Yeah, good. Awesome. Yeah. And just that little awareness, like just starting there, like, yeah, to notice. And that is huge. Like just that little awareness.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the reasons, as I was mentioning before, that we become so stressed is because we live in this like digital age and we have the forward shoulder, and like not only are we physically pulled forward into this position, but it feels like mental and emotional wise, we're pulled in a million different directions. We're constantly being bombarded by like ads and social media, and we constantly feel like we have a million things to do on our to-do lists. So what are some of your favorite ways to help manage our well-being in this crazy digital age?
Mm-hmm. And I keep saying self-observation and self-awareness, but it definitely loops back to that. And I think, you know, I think that the phone, if we look at it or whatever, you know, whatever we're using a lot of, whether it be Instagram or emails, but I think that it can actually serve as a really beautiful tool for self-awareness because it tends to be something that we get addicted to and that draws us in so quickly. And so if we just look at it like that, like, oh, my digital use can be a really potent tool for my own self-observation. And so, you know, one thing, like really practical thing, exercise to do is to do something like when we did an online course for being well in a digital age a couple of years ago, and we gave assignments like, each time you find yourself reaching for your phone, unless it's something else for you, each time you find yourself reaching for your digital device, pause and take 5 deep breaths, or pause and do the expanded exhale exercise for 30 seconds, something like that. And what works for everybody is a little different, as we've talked about with the bio-individuality, same thing here. So just creating a little exercise for yourself each time you reach to do that thing. And so that's huge, you know, having the self-awareness, because that takes a lot of self-discipline and awareness to even, you know, dedicate yourself to that is really creates a lot of discipline and self-observation. And then beyond that, you know, just like with everything else, whether it be the way we're sitting or the way our food is feeling in our bodies, you know, just noticing how is this making me feel? Because social media is not all bad. You know, digital devices aren't all bad. There's a lot of wonderful things and connectivity that can come from them as well. But we tend to get sucked in. And again, it's addictive. And just keeping sight of how it's making you feel and why you're using it. Like, is it purposeful or am I feeling this sort of addictive, repetitive thing happening?
Yeah, especially arming yourself with the knowledge that social media was designed to be addictive, and like not feeling bad that you then start to become addicted to it. You know, it's kind of like, it's like cigarettes. It's the same thing. It's like you, when you start using cigarettes, you kind of expect to become addicted to it because nicotine is an addictive substance. Mm-hmm. And that's why it takes so long for people to quit. And that's why it's so hard. I was listening to this book called Irresistible that talks about like the addictive nature of social media. Also highly recommend it to everyone. But even when you just tell yourself like this is supposed to be addictive so that you don't start to feel as bad, because then there's this kind of like shame aspect that's attached to the addiction to social media. And it's like, okay, well now, like you were saying before, I can have a little compassion for myself and more understanding in the awareness that, okay, this is something that I use a lot. Maybe I don't use it in the most positive way all the time, or maybe I'm using it to distract myself or numb myself from other things. But then using those awareness exercises, like you were saying, of, okay, substituting a different behavior, or even just becoming aware of how many times that you're picking up your phone, using the screen time app to see how much time you're spending on your phone, and then doing small things to change that if you want to, or even just curating your social media feed can be huge things that are super helpful too.
I love that you say that. I love that, because what you said is really at the heart of all wellness, I think, because it's like having self-compassion. You know, I'll even use the phrase, you know, whether it's food or, you know, self-thought that I'm observing, or my use with a digital device, I'll use a phrase for myself. It makes sense that you'd feel this way. Mm-hmm. It's like helping people understand, like creating those sort of like, oh, it makes sense that you'd feel this way. And I love that you said that. And then it helps us, you know, just really embrace common humanity. You know, we have these, of course, yeah, it's scientifically, we know it's addictive, and it is for others as well. And yeah, I love that you say that.
Thank you. So switching gears a little bit, still talking about stress management though, where does gratitude play a role in stress management?
Yeah, I was just talking to someone about gratitude. It was actually in our training we just had with the girls and gratitude practice. And we were talking about all the different ways, you know, the different exercises that we might do in the morning to practice mindful awareness. And what I shared with them is that for me, I find that gratitude is one of those that I reach for on harder days. So like some days in my morning, I'll usually take 20 minutes in the morning to have some sort of practice for myself. And sometimes it's super easy just to sit and observe my thoughts, you know, and some days it's just not easy. And some days it's super easy for me to practice a breathing exercise. But the days that I'm having a little harder time, things are a little tougher, I'm a little more stressed, a little more anxious, I find that gratitude is such a potent tool, because it's just, it immediately shifts all those things that you're so concerned and worried about. Even if it's only for a few minutes, it takes you out of that state of all the things that seem so huge and big and stressful, and helps to just shift everything. And when I teach gratitude practice, I always teach it in a way that I'll say, okay, think of something, you know, that you're grateful for, but then go farther than that. I say, actually feel details about that thing. So for instance, you know, my we're empty nesters this year, and my three kids are away at college. And so, you know, often I miss them, and oftentimes I'll bring my kids to mind, and then I'll remember what they smell like and what their faces feel like. And I think that when we go a little farther into that embodied sense, then we start to really have a shift in our physiology. And sometimes my gratitude, you know, object of choice is that moment I get home from anywhere and I walk in the door, my dog is so freaking happy to see me every single time. And he runs laps and we cheer for him, like in a really nerdy way, my husband and I. But those moments that you can actually feel, I just think that once we learn to practice gratitude in a way that we notice the ripple effect in our physiology, then it becomes even more powerful.
Yes, I love that. And it's so funny when you said, like, we don't really think of the really little things that are consistent in our lives as things to be grateful for. We're thinking about like, oh, how was today different from yesterday? And like, what's one thing that really stood out today that I'm grateful for? Not like, oh, every time that I come home, my dog is like the most excited being in the entire world to see me. And it's just, it's so fun. Like, anyone who listens to my podcast and has followed along on my Instagram, I have a little spaniel, and she's the most insane. Like, she's four. When I first got her, the guy at the farm where I got her was like, oh yeah, she'll probably calm down when she's about one. Has not happened. She's like the most high energy dog I've ever experienced in my whole life. She's crazy. She walks me. But like, she's always so excited when I get home. And that's funnily enough, something that I hadn't really thought about incorporating into my own gratitude practice, which I do every day. So highly recommend that for everybody.
Yeah.
So when we were emailing before we started talking today, one of the things that you had mentioned that you like talking about is how your story of growing up with anxiety and stress and an eating disorder, and how you were able to use those tools that we've been talking about of self-compassion and resilience to overcome those things. So could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, gosh, working on that every day. And I again, I'm gonna say it comes back to something that's such a been a gift in my life, in the ability to self-observe, and something that I think that look reflecting back in the midst of when I was in the most in the grips of those things, I didn't have a sense of separateness between the way I felt and things that were happening to me and thoughts that I was having, emotions that I was having, and myself. And so I felt like I was those things. If I had a really anxious period in my life, like it wasn't, oh, I was having anxious thoughts. I was anxious, and I had a really hard time separating myself from that, and really didn't even understand that concept at a young age. And so as I began to realize I am not my thoughts, and I'm really not even my emotions, they're real and something to be embraced and honored, but I'm really not those either, that I have the ability to witness myself from the space of self-observation. So I use that, term, and that's what such something that I really teach a lot is self-observation and self-awareness. But I truly think that for me, that's everything. I'll say I was just sharing with a friend this morning. I went to the mall yesterday, and I don't go to the mall. Like I just don't. I haven't been in many years, and it's been a while. And I rarely, rarely go. And I yesterday when I went to the mall, it's such a trigger for me. Walking, being there, and the body sensations. Like I always feeling that way, and telling myself that it makes sense that I feel it. I feel that way, and having some compassion around it. But really, every step in my journey has come back to this ability to self-observe. And even with anxiousness, feeling stressed and knowing, there's the kind of the bigger space that I can observe myself and maybe journal and have some reflection around these thoughts I'm having. Or right now in this moment, I know that I can use my breath in a specific way, and it's going to have a profound shift on my physiology and my mental state. And so there's those in the moment tools. And then there's the bigger, more reflective self-inquiry tools as well. And then I'll just add on to that, like, and I mentioned a while back being able, when I started cycling, the sense of feeling strong in my body was something that I always kind of longed for, but never had the courage, or for whatever reason, didn't experience that until after I had children. And even today, like the sense of being able to be in my body, feeling my breath, feeling my heart rate rising, feeling sweat and feeling, even feeling strong, feeling not so strong, all of those things are such a potent tool for myself as well. Because when I'm in those elements, when I'm sensing in that somatic experience, there's not a lot of space to be caught in the, the hurricane or such that we tend to get caught in of thinking, the repetitive rumination and things that tend to limit our ability to be who we really are.
Yes, I love that. That is so cool. And even just coming back to what you said at the very beginning of the podcast, like you are not your thoughts. I feel like that's such a powerful tool that we can use in really any aspect of our lives, whether we're dealing with body image issues or our relationship with food or extreme anxiety or stress or really any like autoimmune disease, digestive condition. It's really, I was reading a book yesterday and it talks about how, emotions are felt in the body and reactions are in the mind. And so it's kind of like learning how to distinguish, okay, what when you're having or going through this experience or having this emotion or whatever it is, where bringing the awareness back to the body and figuring out what does it actually feel like? What does it look like? Does it have a color associated to it? Like, what is it? And then detaching yourself from that and realizing you can have a completely different experience in your body without the known association that we've come to know what that is in your mind. Like, okay, are you feeling sad? What does that feel like in your body? Are you actually feeling sad, or are you just attributing that word to this because that's what we've come to associate with sadness? And even, I mean, that sounds like kind of like a little bit of a mind fuck, right? But like, it's like an existential thing that you can start to like basically remove yourself from the situation. And if you then became the little like angel devil on your shoulder and got to look at yourself, what would that person or that little alien that's just coming down from the sky who has no concept of knowing what is sadness, right? They would be able to describe what you look like, what you're seeming like, you're feeling like, all these other things, but they wouldn't know, is this sadness? Is this loneliness? What is this reaction that we're having to this emotional response in the body?
Mm-hmm. It makes so much sense because that's how we work. I mean, we have this neural wiring that happens, and before we know it, we already have determined what all these things feel like and what they mean. And are in, I think, part of, you know, self-awareness and that path of transforming anything is knowing that we have the choice to make things new. And that's at the heart of neuroplasticity. So it makes so much sense. Yeah,
the choice to make things new. And even if you can't get to that point yet or wrap your head around that, even just allowing yourself to get curious about these things that you're experiencing instead of labeling them as good or bad or healthy or unhealthy or any of these dichotomies that we have that we then attach to shame and guilt and all of these negative emotions and reactions that we have both in the body and in the mind, of just allowing yourself, whether that's reconnecting with your breath or that's just becoming more self-aware and inquiring about like what is going on here, getting curious about it. And then maybe once you start to discover what that is, having a little bit of compassion for yourself of saying like, you know, whatever I'm going through, even just saying like, this is hard and that's okay. And having some compassion for yourself about that is like, not everything is going to be butterflies and rainbows, right? In any part of our lives. And we know that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is going to be like storms that we have to go through. And that's fine too, because no one has a perfectly rosy life despite what their Instagram looks like. And they're not showing you like what the negative or the hard parts are. And even if they are, they're probably not sharing everything. And that's okay too.
I love that. I often say I like that. That embodied sense, like if we can just lean into those things that we're feeling, like to me, that's my most powerful spiritual path, like just leaning into those things. And I love that you said, if you can't wrap your head around it, that's okay. And I, it's so important because sometimes, you know, you may see these things in your body, or for myself, I'll see these things rise within me emotionally. And gosh, I can't even put words to it or connect any dots. But I can say, I'm gonna give a little love to that space within me today. Or I use the phrase often too, like I'm gonna wrap my loving arms around that. I don't even know what it is, or I don't even know if I can change it, or need to change it, or want to change it right now. But I can lean into it and give it a little love.
Yeah. And it's funny, just like a little personal insight. I'm talking about this very confidently as if I know exactly how to do this and I do it every day. I just learned about this a couple of maybe months ago, and it's something that I really struggle with because I am the kind of person where I think much more with my head than with my emotions. And I think it's to become detached from a lot of those emotions, right? So that I don't have to feel them. And so I've been working on a lot then identifying like what the feeling is and then allowing myself to not push it away, but like sit with it and then really feel what that is and what specifically that feels like, looks like, sounds like in the body. And so just a little insight into my personal life here is like, I'm not good at this, but I'm working on it.
I hear you. Yeah. It's an everyday practice, but wow, such a powerful one though, because we, as humans, we spend so much time doing the, you know, opposite. And I know for myself, for many years of my life, it was more about how do I make this go away? How do I numb this? How do I avoid this? You know, it's powerful stuff.
Yes, definitely. Well, thank you so, so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. This is something that I haven't really delved into a lot in the episode, so I think this will bring a really cool perspective to the listeners and stuff. So please let people know where they can find all of your work.
Yeah, so my website is Stacy, S-T-A-C-Y, Dawkins, D-O-C-K-I-N-S.com. And that has a lot of information about the things that we do and the programs that we hold. It also has information about my book, which can be found on Amazon. And it's in paperback and Kindle. And it's called Embodied Posture, Your Unique body and yoga. And it covers a lot. It's a really heavy anatomy biomechanics book, but it talks a lot about just the idea of using the understanding of the body for re-embodiment. So anyone who's interested in that might really like it. And that's probably good enough.
That's awesome. Well, thank you again so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk with Dana. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with your family and friends and share the love by throwing us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, which will help spread the word and do a small part to correct all of the fitness and nutrition misinformation or bullshit that's out there, which is only causing people to become more unhealthy. Come find me anywhere at Real Food with Dana on Instagram and Facebook. Join the Real Talk with Dana Facebook group for more support and discussion on these episodes. And come hang out over on realfoodwithdana.com for the show notes and totally epic and delicious recipes.